This is part one in a three-part series. This episode contains discussion of violence, murder, and crime scenes. Listener discretion is advised. This is The Fall Line. January 1977, Atlanta. There was a cold snap that month, the kind the South is never prepared for. So frigid that the rivers and the ponds iced over, and the wind cut through winter jackets and hurried pedestrians down city sidewalks. It felt more like the Big Apple than the city too busy to hate. Fitting, because New York City would soon make national headlines. The police there were slowly connecting a series of murders to a single killer. In July of 1976, just 6 months before, someone had begun to kill young couples sitting in parked cars. By the end of January of 1977, four couples had been attacked, and the NYPD were on the lookout for a man they were calling the .44 caliber killer. He wouldn't declare his own preferred moniker, the Son of Sam, until the summer of 1977, when his arrest was imminent. The murders of couples at Lover's Lanes, that is, the attacks on couples who were parking, as the old euphemism goes, covering anything from kissing to sexual intercourse, would be a near constant theme in the late 1970s. The nationwide release of the horror movie The Town That Dreaded Sundown came out on December 24, 1976. It played in theaters across the country, including Atlanta. The gory, over-the-top film was loosely based on the very real, very unsolved Tex Arcana Moonlight murders. Just after World War II, a rural county in Tex Arcana was besieged by an unknown killer. The press called him the Phantom Killer, or sometimes the Phantom Slayer, who murdered five and wounded eight. His initial targets were couples who'd snuck off to find a little privacy in the safety of their cars. His attacks came at oddly routine intervals, 3 or 4 weeks apart, always on the weekend, throughout the spring of 1946. According to two witnesses, the Phantom wore a makeshift mask fashioned of white cloth with holes cut out for his eyes, something similar to the Zodiac Killer's hood some two decades later. Per Texas Monthly, local authorities set out teenage decoys, children of Texas Rangers, in hopes of attracting the Phantom, but never managed to capture him. There were strong suspects, though, and even now, experts argue over who the Moonlight Killer really was. The release of The Town That Dreaded Sundown, 3 decades after the crimes, introduced the story to a generation of Americans who'd never heard it, who might treat it like a ghoulish fiction. And the movie is certainly over the top, schlock horror that can only claim to be based on a true story, by the loosest thread. But Lover's Lane murders were in the zeitgeist in early January of 1977, when the movie played in theaters, and the murders in New York formed a pattern that would be recognized in a matter of weeks. New York City might have had a reputation for danger, but so did Atlanta. According to Bernard Headley, a scholar of the Atlanta child murders, the homicide rates in the city would nearly double between 1977 and 1979. That's when Atlanta, once again, earned the title that no city wants, the murder capital of the United States. But Atlantans weren't only facing homicide. According to Headley's book, The Atlanta Youth Murders and the Politics of Race, everything was on the rise. Assault, aggravated robbery, rape. And at the same time, the police force had diminished. Per Headley, that was due to a number of factors. A prickly relationship with Maynard Jackson, Atlanta's new mayor and first black mayor, and his appointees. The establishment of the Fulton County Police Department that drew officers from the city force. In 1977, the Atlanta Police Bureau was midway through what Headley called a, quote, six-year fight over the racial makeup of the force. There was public outcry over misuse of public funds. And then, according to Atlanta Magazine, 1978 brought a cheating scandal regarding promotion exams. What made Atlanta attractive hunting ground? More than one serial killer moved through the city in the late 1970s. No matter your opinion on the guilt or innocence of Wayne Williams, there are the strangulation murders of sex workers. Those came in waves starting in the 70s that marked this city as America's largest unsolved homicide cluster. Thomas Hargrove of the Murder Accountability Project and the researchers who worked with him, they believe that multiple killers were operating here, and for decades. But there's another story, one that has drifted out of the city's memory. Six cold cases, predating the Atlanta child murders. These serial killings didn't make a significant impact on the national news. A series that began in the freezing January of 1977, when The Town That Dreaded Sundown had been in theaters for 3 weeks, and Atlanta was experiencing an unseasonable hard freeze. The weekend of January 16th was the beginning, not that anyone knew it. According to the Charleston News and Courier, it would be, quote, the start of the biggest murder case in Atlanta in 20 years. A killer would hunt for 3 months. The people he preyed on, they'd keep driving to the city's parks with their lovers, hoping to spend some time alone in the relative privacy of their cars. They weren't afraid. They'd have no idea. Not until it was too late. It was 8 p.m. on Sunday, January 16th, when a man driving down Beecher Road in southwest Atlanta came upon an accident. Or what he thought was an accident. A light blue Plymouth Satellite had run into a tree. According to Atlanta police records, the concerned driver got out of his vehicle and headed over to see if the other driver needed help. But he never made it all the way over, because the Plymouth's engine revved and the car suddenly veered backwards, crashing into a metal bus stop sign. The concerned Samaritan later told police, "From where I was, I could see a hand moving inside the back seat of the car. I walked over and knocked on the passenger window, and I asked the man inside if he was all right. I could hear someone hollering, 'Help me,' and the man didn't move or answer me. That's when I heard the female in the back seat. She told me she was shot in the stomach. The man never did say anything. He just fell against the door. A taxicab driver pulled up, and I told the driver of the cab to call an ambulance." While he waited, the driver found a jacket in the front seat of the car and draped it over the young woman in the back seat. The taxi driver did as he was asked and made it to the nearest fire station. Firefighters there contacted APD and also attended the scene. Though the young man was covered in blood, the whole front seat was. His injury wasn't easy to pinpoint. It was only later, at Grady Memorial Hospital, that doctors would discover that LeBrian Lovett, 26 years old, had been shot 4 times, in the head, stomach, arm, and thigh. Veronica Hill, 20, was shot in the stomach and the leg. LeBrian was pronounced dead at 2 a.m. after hours of surgery. Veronica Hill, she died on the way to the hospital. But she'd been able to tell the officers at the scene something, that the couple had been shot at Adams Park in southwest Atlanta. Evidence at the scene helped police determine that the couple had been in the back seat when the gunman opened fire. The car doors must have been unlocked. He hadn't needed to shoot through the glass. 38 caliber bullet casings were discovered in the car, later identified as wad cutter ammo, which is used for target practice. Ken Willis of the Atlanta Constitution would write a story about the murders of LeBrian Lovett and Veronica Hill, but no one thought they'd been killed by a stranger. Before Veronica died, she may have given conflicting statements. Reportedly, she told one person on scene that she and LeBrian had been shot by a friend, and another person that she didn't know the attacker. A third witness thought that it was someone in the crowd at the scene of the crash who said that Veronica knew the killer. Based on the police files, the early investigation focused on people known to either Veronica or LeBrien, like another man she dated. But that man had an alibi. He'd been at a local roller rink that night and was seen by plenty of people. And Atlanta police would go on to rule out other possible suspects, one by one, in the coming weeks. LeBrien and Veronica had been dating on and off for 3 years. They were both parents. He had a toddler son and she had a toddler daughter. They both had siblings, some already married with families of their own, and they had mothers and fathers who, that January, would receive early morning phone calls from homicide detectives. Both families had seen the couple that day. They'd eaten lunch with one of LeBrien's sisters and her husband after church, and dropped Veronica's daughter off at her mother's house. In fact, the couple had actually promised to come back and take Veronica's mother to the laundromat at around 10 p.m. on that night, the 16th. Instead, Veronica's mother would wait, wondering what had become of her daughter. The funeral notices for LeBrien and Veronica ran on the same day, in the Wednesday, January 19th edition of the Atlanta Constitution. Both their funerals were held the next day, at 1 p.m., in the Grant Chapel AME Church in East Point, a metro Atlanta suburb. Because the same reverend presided over both services, mourners would be able to grieve both young people at once. As interviews continued at the Atlanta Police Department headquarters, Veronica Hill and LeBrien Lovett were laid to rest. And couples kept going to Atlanta parks, seeking out privacy. No one knew of the danger, not even after the second attack. On Saturday, February 12, 1977, Dennis Langston, 18, and Deidre Tatum, 17, had planned to spend the evening together. They'd been going steady for 2 years. Both were still in high school. According to Atlanta police records, Dennis picked Deidre up after a basketball game at Northwestern High School. That was at about 10:30 p.m. They drove his white Ford over to a party in the West Side, but they didn't stay long. Instead, they decided to cruise on through the Atlanta University Center, Clark Atlanta University, Spelman College, Morehouse College, and the Morehouse School of Medicine in Southwest Atlanta. But nothing much was happening there either. The couple finally settled on a park, West Manor Park, across from Southside High School. Per APD files, that's where they parked the Ford. They'd been there for only 30 minutes or so when Deidre told Dennis that she heard a car door slam. If there was anyone there, though, they didn't disturb the couple. Not then. At 2:30 a.m., Deidre and Dennis were getting ready to drive home. Then, the glass of Deidre's window exploded. There was a flash of light, then cracks of gunfire, maybe 6 shots. Dennis leapt from the car, searching for what, who, had attacked them. He would tell the APD just after his release from the hospital that he didn't see anyone. But 2 years later, in an interview with the Atlanta Constitution's reporter Ken Willis, Dennis would recall the shape of a man disappearing into the brush of the park. In that same interview, Dennis recalled seeing Deidre in the car, bleeding. She'd been shot in the side. Dennis had been shot, too, in the chest. He wouldn't realize that, though, not until later. There was only one thing he could think, that he had to get Deidre somewhere safe. He told Ken Willis that he drove his girlfriend straight to her apartment. In a state of shock, he hadn't even noticed that he'd passed by a hospital. Ken Willis, the reporter who covered the murder of LeBrien Lovett and Veronica Hill, he wouldn't hear this story from Dennis until much later. He wouldn't hear about the second Lover's Lane attack when he went to the police station downtown, making his rounds on the crime beat. In fact, he wouldn't find out about Dennis and Deidre until March. Not until after a third couple had been stalked in a city park. Atlanta police immediately made the connection between the shooting at West Manor Park and the first, a month before, at Adams Park. The circumstances were so similar. Young black couples parked in Southwest Atlanta recreation areas on Saturday nights. Bullets collected at the second scene were also .38s. The lab technicians would tell APD detectives that They'd likely been fired from a Colt 38 revolver, and they were wad cutters. Technicians were able to collect multiple blood samples at the scene of the crime. Deidre and Dennis had different blood types, and investigators hoped to find one sample that didn't match either of them, the first step in identifying whoever was targeting young couples. Deidre and Dennis both survived the attack. As Ken Willis pointed out in a later article, the locked doors on Dennis's Ford are what saved them. The unknown gunman had been forced to shoot through the glass, giving the couple just enough of a barrier. And there was a good chance, with all that shattered glass, that he'd gotten cut himself. The file notes that the blood-spattered glass was successfully typed as B positive, but without a note included about Deidre and Dennis's blood types, we can't know if this was helpful in narrowing down the suspect profile. This time, detectives took a different investigatory route. Though they asked about the couple's potential enemies, they were more focused on the perpetrator. It seems that they had already begun to work under the theory that they were dealing with a serial killer. Because on February 18th, Sergeant Bolton in Homicide placed a call to the FBI. Specifically, to the Behavioral Science Unit at Quantico, which had only been established 5 years before. Sergeant Bolton spoke to Special Agent Howard Tinton. Though he's called a behavioral science expert in the report, the term you may be more familiar with is profiler. What information Agent Tinton was given is not included, but we do get the details of his assessment. He told Sergeant Bolton the following, that the unidentified suspect was, quote, 20 to 55 years of age, may feel that he or she owns the area in which the crime is being committed, may feel that he or she is wiping out sin. The perpetrator will be a loner. Chances are the perpetrator will be single, though marriage cannot be ruled out. The subject may have had an argument in the parks before the shootings occurred. Will have paranoid schizophrenia. Will live in the area in which the crimes are being committed. If the movie The Town That Dreaded Sundown set him off, he will be no more than 36 years of age. That was the movie about the Texarkana Moonlight Killer that had been released just 2 weeks before LeBrian and Veronica were shot. The idea that a killer might be influenced by pop culture, whether fictional or real, that is a serious concern. There have been copycats based on everything from movies like Taxi Driver and Saw to television shows like Dexter. Murderers have mirrored the actions of the Zodiac Killer, Jack the Ripper, and the unknown perpetrator of the 1982 Tylenol murders. What's interesting about this statement, to us, is the specificity of the age. Why 36? The profile doesn't go into detail. And Special Agent Tinham doesn't comment on the length of time between the attacks, which was 28 days. But at that time, he couldn't have known it was going to be a pattern. Not a perfect pattern, but close. Not until the night of March 12th. According to the Constitution, the APD began a map of Atlanta parks. Lieutenant W.K. Perry, then in charge of homicide, knew that both Adams and West Manor were known as Lover's Lanes, and that couples visited both. And he wanted to mark any other potential targets. As he noted to Willis in an interview that was granted, upon the condition that it be withheld until APD cleared its release, he didn't believe the killer would stop at two shootings. After all, each time he'd attacked, he'd emptied his gun into the cars. This man has a mission, Lieutenant Perry said, and he won't stop until he's done. But a month passes quickly when you're looking for a suspect with so few known factors, a caliber of bullet, a profile, and the tips weren't coming in from residents of Atlanta. They had no idea that APD was hunting for a killer, because the attack on Dennis and Deidre hadn't been publicly connected to the murders of LeBrian and Veronica. And as spring inched up across Atlanta, the parks would become more popular. The South warms up quickly. Gordon Whitfield, 21, and Diane Collins, 20, went to Adams Park the same place that LeBrian Lovett and Veronica Hill had been shot, late on Saturday night, March 12, 1977. Gordon, who was called Darnell, his middle name by his family, had just returned to Atlanta. Per the Constitution, he'd been gone for 6 months, quote, on active duty service in the Army. Diane was enrolled in beauty school, and they had big plans. They'd just gotten engaged. According to reporter Ken Willis, they'd been on a date that night to see A Star is Born in a local theater. Afterward, they headed to a park to spend some time alone. Police would later note that the couple parked near a blue dumpster over by the tennis courts. There was at least one other car in the vicinity of Gordon's gray Chevrolet. He assumed that another couple was in there. It was probably an Oldsmobile, maybe a Delta, maybe not. Gordon couldn't make out anyone inside. Sometime after midnight, the front passenger door of the Chevrolet was yanked open. Gordon saw a black male, somewhere between 25 and 35 years old, crouched down. He was wearing a knit ski cap, light-colored, maybe yellow. He was holding a gun. The man began firing, and Gordon tried to grab his arm to shove the gun away. At some point, he shoved the man's leg, and he would later tell police it felt strong, like the man had a muscular build. Gordon felt his face burn. Noise and smoke filled up the car. And then, suddenly, the man ran into the darkness of the park. Around 1 a.m., Gordon Whitfield's family heard someone honking a car's horn outside their home. It was Gordon, bleeding from wounds to his head, with Diane lying next to him in the front seat. He'd managed to drive home. According to police reports, he'd made it out of the car and staggered toward the front door, intent on finding help for her. His sister spotted him, and her screams roused the rest of the house. As Gordon's mother called for help, others rushed outside to try and assist the couple. The passenger door was opened so that Diane could be seen to. Gordon's family wiped the blood from her face, put a towel under her head, draped a blanket around her. Gordon was helped to the floor. He could no longer stand up. Later, emergency services would arrive. Diane was declared dead at the scene. Gordon was rushed to the hospital, in critical condition. They'd both been shot in the head. That burning feeling Gordon described? It had been bullets. Gordon was questioned as soon as he was out of surgery, and he was able to supply detectives with their first description of the killer, one they used to focus on anyone who'd been in and around the park. This led them to question a number of men who'd come up in the course of the investigation, either for committing crimes in the area or for their documented past behavior in the same park. But they seemed most focused on two things: the kind of ammunition the gunman used, Hornaday wad cutters, and the stance he assumed when he shot, that crouched position. They developed exhaustive lists of Hornaday ammo sales in Georgia. Most of the ammo went to law enforcement for target practice in numerous counties, but some had been sold in the private sector. The APD tracked down stores that sold it and began the process of compiling lists of every person who had purchased the ammunition in the state. It would be a long process. They could not be certain the killer would have purchased his own ammo. It could have been stolen, bought out of state, but it was a place to start. And there was something else. Both the stance and the bullets led some to believe that the killer might have a law enforcement or military background, either present or former, or perhaps a position as a security guard. We spoke to retired APD Lieutenant Danny Egan for this series. Again, he was still working in narcotics in 77. He wouldn't move to homicide until sometime later, when he was one of the people working the Atlanta child murders. However, he participated in the stakeouts that were executed in hopes of catching the Atlanta Lovers Lane killer. He was able to walk us through an explanation of the wad cutter ammunition, the practices at the APD shooting ranges in the 1970s, and the general availability of the bullets. He also explained the crouch stance and its import.
Do you think this was ammunition a civilian would have had a fairly easy time getting their hands on?
Semi-wad cutter ammunition is not something that is controlled. It's not something that people can't get. A lot of stores back during the day, and probably still do to this day, will not carry it because it's not in high demand. It's got a very limited purpose, and that purpose is target shooting. It never was designed for combat or self-defense. It's a target shooting round. And the reason it's good for target shooting is it makes a perfectly clean round hole the size of a 38 bullet. If you shoot a round nose 38 bullet, the hole is somewhat jagged. But this type of ammunition is a very clean, well-defined hole. So if you're scoring a target, it's easy to score it. You can see. Sometimes, believe it or not, you put bullets in the same hole. This happens more frequently than people will think. The availability of this ammunition would depend on what kind of store you were shopping in. I don't know that I've ever seen wad cutter ammunition, say, at the Kmart, back when Kmart was selling bullets, or the Walmart, back when Walmart was selling bullets. You would pretty much have to go to a gun store, somebody that deals in firearms, different types of ammunition, and that's probably where you would find it. So to answer your question, this was not readily available ammunition, but it was available, and it could have indicated the nature of who was shooting the gun at the time these crimes were committed. The assumption being that this is somebody that's doing target shooting, that somebody could maybe have taken it from the firearms range. APD, when we qualified from day one in 1974, when I went through the academy, we used wad cutter ammunition. And there were buckets of it, barrels of it, because we would shoot a lot of bullets. So that's the kind of bullet that you would use at the range. But I always was under the impression that the bullets at APD were reloaded ammunition, and they were really crappy bullets. They didn't have a lot of powder in them. The quality of each round was not the best. Give you, for instance, shooting from the 60-yard line. Back then, we would shoot from the 60-yard line. You could actually see the bullet traveling down the lane before it hit the target. That's how slow the bullet was moving. So at 60 yards, you would have to raise the muzzle of the revolver about 10 or 12 inches above the point of impact to make it drop into place. Now, 7 yards away, it didn't make a difference. But at 60 yards, you could actually see the bullet go down the range.
As a follow-up question, if a person was going to a firing range just to learn how to use a gun and they were not aware, would they have been told that the ammunition they were buying was just for the target range and that it would have been better if they had gotten other bullets for like self-defense?
If somebody were such a novice with guns, never had held a gun, and they're going to buy a gun, somebody will walk in a gun store and they say, I want to buy a gun. And the gun store clerk says, well, what are you going to do with it? What are you wanting to buy a gun for? Well, for self-defense, for target practice. Well, the gun store clerk is, if they're trying to do their job correctly, going to direct them in the direction of the kind of bullet or the type of gun that they need to get. And then they're going to say, these are the kind of bullets that you need to use for target practice, or these are the kind of bullets that you need to use for self-defense. If these wad cutters were manufactured by Hornaday, which according to the report, they were manufactured by Hornaday, these were not reloads made by some guy in his garage. These were bullets that came from a factory. If these bullets would have likely been in a box, and the box would have said target range or target bullets, they would be designated. Bullets now say self-defense. There would have been a designation on the box suggesting what the use of these bullets would have been best for. This could have been somebody that never had fooled with guns before, but I get the feeling not, based on everything that I know about this case. This guy had fired a gun plenty of times and knew what he was doing. This is an excellent question. Why would he have chosen such an ineffective round to shoot and kill people? This is not the best round to do this. Another part of the mystery, another question that makes no sense. I wasn't even aware that there'd been a double murder in the park until sometime well after it had occurred. I don't even know that I heard about the second shootings in the park. I was working in narcotics. I wasn't involved in homicide back then. I knew homicide was busy. So I don't know that I really recall hearing about either one of these. But at some point when I did hear about all of these cases and it's being related to me, what's going on, the crouch is part of the story. Shooting wad cutter ammunition in a crouch position makes you think it's a police officer. This is what I heard. And yeah, those two things right there sounds like this could be a police officer.
What is the purpose of the crouch?
The crouch position does a couple of things. One of them is it maybe lowers your center of gravity, gives you a more stable position to shoot from. And you're talking about a two-hand crouch position is the way I'm understanding this guy was shooting, which is something that was taught at the range. A one-hand crouch position was also taught at the range. But you lower your center of gravity, you're a little bit more stable, and it also reduces the amount of area that somebody can shoot back at you and hit you. The closer to the ground you can get, the better off you are. And training kicks in during a tense situation, and you forget everything else. This is the whole purpose of repetitive training, like with firearms. And sometimes it is very good, and then sometimes it's detrimental to the situation. But people revert back to what they were trained to do. So these people in the car having sex, they're not firing back at you. You really wouldn't need to crouch to present a smaller target. But because you're keyed up, excited, you revert back to your training and you hit this crouch position and you start shooting, or you're in this crouch position when you are shooting. So yeah, that makes sense that it would revert back to what you were taught to do. I mean, all these police shows and these movies show these shooting positions of being in a crouch position when firing a gun, two-hand point shoulder crouch position, what they call it. A lot of people would use it and not even think about it, not knowing why they use it, just because they saw somebody in a movie do it.
Do you think the crouch has anything to do with the logistics of the situation?
The crouch situation at the point that the gun is fired makes sense because the car is lower down than somebody standing up. Somebody standing up, if you're trying to shoot them in the chest, you could shoot them square on. But if somebody's in a car, you're having to shoot down in the car. So it maybe gives you a better angle of fire to crouch, puts you more in line with the target that you're aiming at, which makes sense.
Also, it appeared that they were laying down. If they were sitting up, it would make more sense to fire straight across. But if these people are laying down, you need to get low enough to get them.
Well, think about a car, though. Even if somebody's sitting up in a car, you're having to lean over into a car to get face to face with them because they're lower than you are, generally, unless it's one of those jacked up pickup trucks. But these were just regular passenger cars, which would have been relatively low in relation to somebody standing up next to them. So crouching or leaning to shoot more effectively is maybe a valid reason why this position was assumed.
I'm almost 6 feet tall, so if I was coming up to a car and I actually wanted to aim into that car and be able to shoot well, I'd naturally assume that kind of stance.
That's the point I'm making. I mean, to get an effective line of fire, you're going to have to lean down or aim down, and maybe crouching is better because you crouch just a little bit, drop your center of gravity 3 or 4 inches, then that drops your aim point 3 or 4 inches, which is maybe all you need to shoot somebody in the head or the chest. It could be law enforcement, but it could be something else. Once again, people mimicking what they've seen in a movie.
With the bullets as a lead, the APD continued their investigation. They were looking into numerous possibilities, both civilian and law enforcement, men who had either been in parks or raised some alarm in the people around them, enough that they came to mind when the crimes were committed. They were especially focused on a man known to Diane Collins' family and a local security guard. But as the days passed, there would be other possibilities. Ex-law enforcement from South Georgia, and a rapist who claimed during attacks to be the Lover's Lane killer. And April was coming. If the Lover's Lane killer was truly following a schedule, he would attack again in 28 or 29 days. There wasn't a good theory as to why he followed that pattern. Only the knowledge that he did. Only the knowledge that there wasn't much time. They would plan a stakeout and try to catch him in one of the parks in the city, all while Atlanta moved on around them, unaware. Well, most of Atlanta. Some local reporters knew, like Ken Willis. They'd been asked to keep the story under wraps, to preserve the investigation. But as the chance of a higher death toll loomed, that promise became impossible to keep. Next time on The Fall Line, the story of the Atlanta Lovers Lane murders breaks in the Atlanta Constitution, and the APD stakes out two city parks in search of a killer. If you have any information regarding the attacks and murders that took place between January and March of 1977 in Adams and West Manor Park, call the Atlanta Police Department's Homicide Unit at 404-546-4235. Thank you for listening. The Fall Line is a fully independent show, and we appreciate listener support. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIAs, pay our content advisors, and support and donate to the causes we care about. If you try out the products we advertise, please use our sponsor codes. It really helps. And if you'd like to support the show and the stories that we cover, join us on Patreon. We're raising funds to continue to pay for the Milberg Twins billboard in Augusta and to fund therapy for families who've been on the show. Recently, we've been able to fund a year of therapy for two people, and we want to expand that. Each and every one of our patrons helps us to continue this work, and we're so grateful for your help. On Patreon, you can get early release ad-free versions of our regular episodes, plus blogs and videos for only $5 a month. We've also added video live streams, which all patrons can enjoy, starting at just a dollar. The Fall Line is written, researched, and hosted by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Waters, Kim Fritz, Shannon Geary, and Haley Gray. Family interviews by Brooke Hargrove. Produced, engineered, and scored by Maura Curry. Content advisement by Brandy C. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. And, as always, our most special thanks to Angie Dodd. We'd also like to thank Ken Willis and Danny Egan. Currently, our monthly donation is going to Private Investigations for the Missing. Please join us in supporting this nonprofit. They need funds to help families access the service of PIs.